Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine, and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing, and the opinions and views you hear here are not necessarily those of the station, but those of me and my guests, so I hope you have a good time listening. Today my guest is mystery author Michael Connelly, author of 10 novels, including The Poet, The Concrete Blonde, Void Moon, and he's also a writer of anthologized short stories. After graduating from the University of Florida in 1980, Mike worked at newspapers in Daytona Beach and Fort Lauderdale, primarily specializing in the crime beat. Then, in 1986, he and two other reporters spent several months interviewing survivors of a major airline crash and turned this into a story that was later nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. The story also landed him a job as a crime reporter for the Los Angeles Times and brought him to the city of which his literary hero, Raymond Chandler, had written. After 3 years on the crime beat, Michael Connelly began writing his first novel, Black Echo, to feature LAPD Detective Hieronymus Bosch. Black Echo was published in 1992 and later won the Edgar Award for the best first novel by the Mystery Writers of America. He's also won a Nero Wolfe Award, a McCavity Award, and an Anthony Award. His current book, A Darkness More Than Night, has just come out. Are you there, Michael?
Yes.
How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're sure welcome. At the beginning of A Darkness More Than Night, your main character, Terry McAuliffe, is introduced. Could you talk about the genesis for this character?
Yeah, it was pretty simple. It came from a friend of mine named Terry, who had had a heart transplant back in 1993. And I knew him before and after. And just watching the changes he went through, the journey, the medical journey and the psychological and even spiritual journey he went through, during this process was very interesting to me as a friend and as a writer. And so, I approached him with the idea of somehow adapting it to what I do, which is write crime novels. My friend Terry was not an FBI agent or anything like that. And he agreed and spent a lot of time with me over the next few years, kind of giving me the details of his life, and so forth, and from that I kind of sculpted, that was the baseline that I sculpted the character of Terry McAuliffe from.
Interesting. So you're so prolific, and you just said you spent a couple of years scoping out the character. Are you sort of working on projects at the same time concurrently? Are you planning one while you're writing another, or how do you do it?
Sometimes I am. I don't do that all the time. But often I'll get an idea that I don't think is right for, say, a Harry Bosch novel. And so I kind of keep it in my back pocket. And to use a journalism phrase, I gather string, meaning it's always there. And as other things come up or I come across things that might be useful with that idea, I put it with that. And so it's always kind of there, and I'm working on it. It happened with this book. This one was one in particular that, I probably didn't start writing it till maybe 3 or 4 years after I had approached Terry and said, I want to write about it. So that was a long period. Another book I wrote called Void Moon about a burglar was one that gathered string for a while.
Interesting. What about Angel's Flight?
Well, Angel's Flight had, it wasn't like an idea that I said, I'm going to write about this and gather string. It was a little bit different. I mean, it was definitely, I think that book came out in 1998, and a lot of its seeds were planted back in 1992 when I was a reporter I was one of the reporters at the LA Times that covered the riots that happened in Los Angeles. And so a lot of what my experience and my feelings about that came out in that book. So that was more of a submerged route into a book.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like in 92 I knew I'm going to write about this someday. It just came up when I did write about it.
I'm also curious about your novel called The Poet,
mm-hmm.
how that began.
that was interesting. That was almost like a writing exercise. It was my fifth book, but it came after four Harry Bosch novels. And so I was looking for something to break away from Harry Bosch and take at least a year off from him, take a break from him. So it was really born out of that. Like, I need to take a break to keep Bosch interesting and fresh. I think the best way of doing that is to leave him alone for a year or so every now and then. And so then when I came to that conclusion, the next step was, well, then what am I going to do? And I had been a journalist for a number of years, and so I kind of went into my own background, and so it came out of that.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Michael Connelly. Speaking of being a journalist, now, you majored in journalism and minored in creative writing. Now you're this incredibly successful writer. Now, had you considered majoring in creative writing and minoring in journalism, or how did that all happen?
Well, when I decided to become a writer, my first move was to creative writing. I was actually studying building construction sciences, believe it or not, when I kind of had the epiphany when I decided I want to be a writer. And so my first instinct or first move was to go into creative writing. Then once, and this is all very quickly, like I'm talking about weeks of decision making, and I started going down that path, I realized it might be wiser to go into a form of writing that could I could earn a living at quickly or right after school. And so that's what, then I switched to a major of journalism and moved creative writing into a minor.
Mm-hmm. So after all that, has your success been surprising? Or just that, I mean, it sounds like you made a practical decision, and here you are just doing sort of just wonderfully.
Well, yeah, everything's always surprising. It's kind of a weird answer, a question to answer, because I think most writers have a fairly substantial ego. I mean, that's what makes them say, I can tell stories that people will be interested in. So on one hand, things are turning out the way I hope, but I guess I have to stress hope, because with writing, talent does not always win out. You need a lot of luck and other support from other people and so forth, and that's where I've been really fortunate, and so therefore, what I hoped might happen 25 years ago when I was in college making these decisions is actually happening, and I realize that there's very few people who can say that.
Yeah, definitely. Your website actually is just massive, and I checked it out, and there are just all the various sites within that site. Your message board, for instance, is interesting and massive, and you answer your messages too, or questions.
Yeah, I can't answer them in too much of a timely manner, but I do get on there once or twice a month and answer questions. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really good website. I think it's pretty interesting. It goes, I think, beyond the books. There's a lot of stuff in there that, you're not going to get out of the books. So if you're interested, it's there.
Yeah, it sure is.
And, how useful it is, I don't really know. I mean, I think there's... It's got a growing number of people that are on there a lot, so I think it's useful or entertaining to them. So it's kind of interesting to kind of watch that and see how it grows and so forth.
And it's unusual in that you, again, will answer questions. It seems that most websites I see anyway are just really the author perhaps talking about the books or listing the books, maybe some excerpts, and that's about it. It's not a lot of interaction, or any interaction, really.
Well, I mean, I think writers all have kind of find their groove of what they're willing or wanting to do. I mean, there's a lot of writers who don't, are not comfortable, even doing a book signing. And I've always found it really fulfilling to talk to people who are reading my stories. And, the website's just another way of doing that.
Do you ever find out things about your stories from people who are reading them that hadn't occurred to you?
Yeah, I often find, people find meanings and so forth in stories or in episodes or even like an answer someone might give that I didn't know are there.
Interesting.
They're not intentional for me, but people find them. And you know, most often I often wish I could say, oh, yeah, I meant that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it's accidental.
Or they unfold the theme to you and you went, all right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's really interesting how that can happen. And, yeah, I wouldn't know about it if I didn't have things like a website or if I didn't do book signings every now and then.
Now, back to A Darkness More Than Night. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest, not my author, is Michael Connelly, and he is the author of A Darkness More Than Night. Has this very, convoluted plot. It's quite dense and interesting. How do you go about plotting? And is it your intention when you're beginning to make it complex? Or, you know, is it just the way you think?
I think it's, you know, an outcrop of the way I'm thinking. I think everything in a book comes out of character. And so I always start with that, but I don't always have the... I never have the whole plot worked out in my head. I usually just have the beginning and end and just start writing and, you know, the plot happens as I'm going. And so it's kind of a mysterious process. I think what happens is when I don't work off of an outline. So when you're not working off of an outline, you're more free to, like, say, well, I'm going to take the story this way here. And so therefore you get a lot more switchbacks that way when you're not looking at an outline. That's the positive side. The negative is, you know, a lot of times when you make it, I'll go this way or I'll go that way, you go the wrong way and you end up throwing out a lot of pages. And that's, you know, just part of the process for me. I would rather throw out the pages with every book, make my mistakes, and then work off of an outline.
Interesting. Will you read a little bit to us?
Yeah, I was going to read... I have to set this up a little bit. Just two sections. One's really short and one's a little bit longer. But this book is kind of like a collision or a clash of Terry McCaleb and Harry Bosch. And Terry McCaleb takes a case, an unsolved murder case he looks into and finds that details of the murder scene resemble the paintings of Hieronymus Bosch. From the 15th century. And this, of course, brings him in contact with Harry Bosch, whose real name is Hieronymus Bosch. So what I was going to read here was this section where Terry is at the Getty Museum up there in Los Angeles, and is kind of getting a briefing on the painter Hieronymus Bosch from a... expert at the museum. And so he's looking at the work of Hieronymus Bosch, and it's having a deep resonance for him. And so this is what I'm reading here takes place in the Getty Museum. The world of Hieronymus Bosch was as striking to McCaleb as it was disturbing. The landscapes of misery that unfolded in the pages Penelope Fitzgerald turned were not unlike some of the most horrible crime scenes he had witnessed. But in these painted scenes, the players were still alive and in pain. The gnashing of teeth and the ripping of flesh were active and real. His canvases were crowded with the damned, human beings tormented for their sins by visible demons and creatures given image by the hand of a horrible imagination. At first, he studied the color reproductions of the paintings in silence, taking it all in the way he would first observe a crime scene photograph. Soon he came to the Garden of Earthly Delights, Bosch's masterpiece. He studied it very closely. The left panel was a bucolic scene of Adam and Eve being placed in the garden by the Creator. An apple tree stood nearby. The center panel, the largest, showed dozens of nudes coupling and dancing in uninhibited lust, riding horses and beautiful birds, and wholly imagined creatures from the lake in the foreground. And then the last panel, the dark one, was the payoff. Hell, a place of torment and anguish administered by monster birds and other ugly creatures. The painting was so detailed and enthralling that McCaleb understood how Fitzgerald might stand before it, the original that is, for 4 hours and still not see everything. I'm sure you are grasping the ideas of Bosch's often repeated themes by now, Fitzgerald said, but this is considered the most coherent of his works as well as the most beautifully imagined and realized. McCaleb nodded and pointed to the three panels as he spoke. You have Adam and Eve here, the good life, until they eat that apple. Then in the center you have what happens after the fall from grace, life without rules. Freedom of choice leads to lust and sin. And where does all this go? Hell. Very good, Fitzgerald said. And if I could just point out a few specifics that might also interest you. Please. She started with the first panel. The earthly paradise. You are correct in that it depicts Adam and Eve before the fall. This pool and fountain at center represent the promise of eternal life. You already noted the fruit tree at left center. Her finger moved across the plate to the fountain structure, a tower of what looked like flower petals that somehow delivered water in four distinct trickles to the pool below. Then he saw it. Her finger stopped below a small dark entrance at the center of the fountain structure. The face of an owl peered from the darkness. You mentioned the owl before. Its image is here. You see, all is not right in this paradise. Evil lurks, and as we know, will ultimately win the day, according to Bosch, that is. Then, going to the next panel, we see the imagery again and again. She pointed out two distinct representations of owls and two other depictions of owl-like creatures. McCaleb's eyes held on one of the images. It showed a large brown owl with the shiny black eyes and being embraced by a nude man. The owl's coloring and eyes matched that of the plastic bird found at the crime scene. Do you see something there, Terry? He pointed to the owl. This one. I can't really go into it with you, but this one, it matches up with the reason I am here. A lot of symbols are at work in this panel, she said. That is one of the obvious ones. After the fall, man's freedom of choice leads him to debauchery, gluttony, folly, and avarice, the worst sin of all in Bosch's world being lust. Man wraps his arms around the owl. He embraces evil. McCaleb nodded, and then he pays for it. Yes, then he pays for it. As you notice in the last panel, this is a depiction of hell without fire. Rather, it is a place of myriad torments and endless pain, of darkness. McCaleb stared silently for a long time, his eyes moving across the landscape of the painting. He remembered what Dr. Voskuhler had said earlier about the darkness in Bosch's paintings. He had called it a darkness more than night. And then I'm just going to jump ahead to that night when McCaleb goes home, and what he's seen in these paintings really is sticking with him.
Okay.
McCaleb decided to leave everything on the boat, thinking that he needed to clear his mind before the next day. Carrying the files and the heavy art books would only remind him of the heavy thoughts he carried within. He locked the boat up and took the Zodiac to the skiff dock. At the end of the pier, he climbed into the golf cart. He rode through the deserted business district of Catalina and up the hill toward home. Despite his efforts to deflect them, his thoughts were of the abyss, a place where creatures with sharp beaks and claws and knives tormented the fallen in perpetuity. He knew one thing for sure at this point. The painter Bosch would have made a good profiler. He knew his stuff. He had a handle on the nightmares that rattle around inside most people's minds, as well as those that sometimes get out.
Hmm. Thank you very much.
Sure.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and you were just listening to Michael Connelly reading from A Darkness More Than Night. Hieronymus Bosch, Harry Bosch's name, names are so important in fiction, and that name is surely a memorable one. Will you talk about how you chose it?
Well, as you said, names are very important in fiction. I think I'm a writer because I'm a reader. And so when I was moving towards the goal of writing novels, I knew from what I had read, from the books I loved, that everything came from characters, I said earlier. And in pursuit of that character, nothing should be, no opportunity should be overlooked. And so a name is a great opportunity to come up with something that has a sense of resonance to it, or a double meaning, et cetera, a metaphor. And, you know, so I spent a lot of time trying to think of a name that would have one of those qualities or all those qualities for this character I was creating. And I was about halfway through what was would become my first published book with a different name when I can't remember exactly what happened, but I had studied Hieronymus Bosch when I was in college, and so then this was about 12 years later. I saw some reference to them, and then everything came crashing back, my memory of the paintings and so forth. And I just suddenly knew, almost like as an epiphany, that that would be a great name, because of the, you know, the painter worked 5 centuries ago, and, you know, his overriding theme is that our own passions often do us in. And, you know, I was going to try to write some novels about Los Angeles, and I saw Los Angeles as possibly being the contemporary Garden of Earthly Delight, or at least the ground that my character was going to move across, which was the dark underside of Los Angeles. And so, you know, in the moment, I put plug and switch on my computer and changed the name.
What was the name?
It was just a single name, Price.
Uh-huh.
And I was working with the idea that, you know, this guy, what he's going to do, he'll pay a price for.
Mm-hmm.
And I used that name later, but I think Around the Splash was a much better name.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, do you give much attention to side characters or less important characters to their names?
Yeah, I mean, everything is a matter of a time and what you can do, but... as I said before, don't lose any kind of opportunity. Yes, your main character is the most important thing, but everything is a plate that you got to keep spinning, you know, on a stick. And everything is important. And so with almost all names, I don't think I throw any names away. I mean, I either try to get them to have some kind of significance, as I said. A lot of times I'll base them on sounds. And then you also always have an opportunity to, you know, acknowledge someone in your life. So some names in my books are just people. Like Terry McCaleb, for example, is a combination of Terry, my friend who had the heart transplant, who inspired a character, and McCaleb is my wife's maiden name.
Interesting.
So that, while that name does not have the kind of resonance that, say, Harry Bosch does, it has some resonance to me.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting. Okay, well, I'm going to take a short break and allow you to take a break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. So all of you out there, don't go away. We'll be right back with more Michael Connelly. Please stay tuned.
And making it minor to major. And so you have Harry Bosch, who, you know, every book has a conflict of trying to solve a murder. But I want him to also have conflicts in his personal life and his own history. In the minutiae of the day, always have conflict, and from that come the flaws and comes the character and so forth. I mean, my kind of like my overriding motto comes from Kurt Vonnegut, who, when asked, like, what's the best piece of advice you could give a writer, said, just make sure in every page of your story, every character wants something, even if it's just a drink of water. And, you know, what he was saying is conflict, 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 you know, and it can be just, I need a drink of water. Harry Bosch, sometimes, I think some of the most telling moments of his character are when he just wants to smoke. And that seems like a minor inconvenience, but it says stuff about people. And so you layer on these conflicts, and what you're really doing is layering on the character. And, you know, that's where it really comes from. I just have some things in my head or ideas that I just try to follow, and I try to always remember when I'm writing that, you know, I'm not, like, for example, another main thing is that I'm not really writing a book about a cop on a case, working on a case. I'm writing a book about a case working on a cop. And there's, you know, a subtle difference there. But if you keep that in mind, you know, your writing moves towards the character as opposed to kind of falling in behind the plot and letting the plot dictate what happens in the story.
That's interesting. I've never quite heard anybody put it that way. How did you come up with that? I mean, working on a case, working on a cop, and not on a cop working on a case.
Well, unfortunately, almost all the things that I follow or that inspire me in my writing come from other writers. And I think that came secondhand from Joseph Weinbaugh. I never heard him say it or saw him say it, but I knew someone who knew him and quoted him that way.
Mm-hmm.
Another writer that, you know, Richard Price, who writes screenplays and books and so forth, one time was said that you know, when you circle around a homicide long enough, you begin to get a sense of a city. And that's another quote that I think really informs my work. So much that I actually paraphrase that in the book I just finished, in which a character, I think it's Harry Bosch, says, you know, that in every murder is the tale of a city. And so I have these kind of like bromides or whatever you want to call them that I keep handy in my head that I try to remember all the time, and they help me when I'm writing, help me kind of keep focused on what I'm trying to do.
Interesting. Now, all of these flaws that Harry has, did they evolve out of, or do they evolve out of just the writing, or did you, before you started that character, even before he had his name, did you come up with these things? Well, I want him to be a police officer. I want him to have some resentments against him by other cops. How far do you go with that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it was, you know, formed at the beginning. A lot of it's established archetype of the genre, you know, the loner detective. I mean, I love Raymond Chandler stuff and Ross McDonald and people like that, but they all wrote about private eyes who were really kind of like lone wolves out there. But I had this, because I was a reporter, I had many years covering the police department, so I had this knowledge of how they do their work that fascinated me and I thought would fascinate readers. So I took what I liked about their characters and put them into a detective, and so that although he carries a badge, he's definitely, I think, an outsider, you know, with an insider's job. And, you know, and so as far as his background goes, most of the detectives in LAPD that I knew at that time had service in the Vietnam War, and so I wanted there to be a sense of realism too to my book. So I had Harry having served in Vietnam. So then I took it another step and brought in another thing I had of interest in, and that was tunnel rats, which was like one of the most frightening parts of that war or duties in that war for soldiers. And I happened to know someone who had done that, so it had been something that fascinated me for years, and I just incorporated that into Harry's character. I was inspired by James Ellroy's real life, that he lost his mother when he was 10 or 11, and it was pretty clear that he was working out whatever damage that did to him by writing murder mysteries. And so I thought about the same thing as far as how about a detective who has a similar history and works it out by solving murders. And, you know, so there's a whole mishmash of inspirations, and a lot of that, almost everything I just talked about, I had before I actually wrote, you know, the first story.
Mm-hmm. Then how much research, or what sort of research do you do then when you're doing a book? How much do you know when you have the idea, and do you have the idea because of all that you know, or is it something that intrigues you and you have to do a certain amount?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all that stuff. I mean, one thing on the Harry Bosch books, which I've written the most of, I do the least research on them because a lot of I was a police reporter for about 12 years, so I just kind of have like an inbred knowledge of police procedure or basic police procedure. And so often with a Harry Bosch book, I just start writing it once I have the idea. I just start writing it. And then when I'm done writing it, I'll give sections or in some cases the whole book to someone who's a cop who can read and tell me if I got stuff wrong. So those are not research-heavy books. Usually the non-Bosch books are the most research-heavy. Void Moon, which is about a burglar and in Las Vegas, I did a lot of research for that on techniques and so forth of surveillance and burglaries and so forth. Security at Las Vegas hotels, I spent a lot of time over there doing that kind of stuff. Blood work, like I said, I gathered string on that for years, spending a lot of time with my friend Terry, talking to his people who cared for him, going with him to a hospital, and, you know, things like that. So I had a good sense of that kind of what the day-to-day life of a heart transplant patient is. So I count that as research.
And when do you stop? When do you know you've had enough? Or at least you have enough to start.
I usually am always writing before I'm done researching because the urge to start telling the story overpowers the urge to get my ducks in a row or get my research done. And I just have to start writing. And that's usually a sign to me that I'm close to having enough. I think there hasn't been a book I've written yet that I did not finish writing it and have to go back and make sure I got something right, or I left parts out that I have to go and research. To me, I kind of like write like a shark, where I have to just keep moving. Once I have the idea, I got to keep going and I got to start writing it. And to me, the worst thing for me, my own personal experience, the worst thing is to be doing research when you wish you could be writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to never have that situation.
Interesting. So mystery writers, or at least fledgling mystery writers, who don't have the experience of, say, being a crime reporter or being a police officer or being a detective, what sort of things for those writers would you recommend that they do if they want to write mysteries?
Well, for one thing, whether you have that experience or not, I would say you got to read. I just don't know anyone. You got to read within the genre, especially within the area that you want to write about. So if you want to write about a police detective, read the police detective novels. If you want to write about Private Eye, then read those. But I mean, you know, and go just to mystery bookstores and find out who the best are at writing these type of things. And I think you learn a lot from that. Your task is to take these established, everyone's writing, you know, basically in an established archetype, and your goal is to within that frame, that established frame, to try to come up with something unique or to turn it a little bit so it has a unique spin on it. And that's the difficult part. But so to me, the knowledge of how, like, cops do something at a crime scene, or how a private eye picks the lock or whatever, that to me is just window dressing. It's very minor compared to what you got to do with a character, and that's create something new within an established box.
Mm-hmm. Ah, if you've just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Michael Connelly, author of A Darkness More Than Night. Earlier, before the break, you said that you don't work off an outline. Does that mean that you do a lot of revision, or is your beginning your actual beginning that you started with, or do you find you often start some other place, or what happens with that?
Well, I do a lot of revision. I do a lot of rewriting. In fact, every morning I rewrite what I did the day before, so that might say, you know, so my first draft actually has a rewrite built into it. And again, it comes out of that expression of writing like a shark, keeping moving. I just want to keep writing to get to the end, because I don't have anything written down like an outline. I often fear that I'll forget my grand plan if I don't get to the end. And so I try to write quickly and get there, and then I come back and rewrite, and you know, maybe the first draft is really just like a skeleton, and then I come back and with more detail kind of put the meat on the bones and so forth. I I'm not saying I recommend this to everyone, because you make a lot of mistakes. I mean, I've thrown out as many as, 250 pages, because of a mistake where I just went in the wrong direction. That's an extreme example, but there's probably not been a book I've written that I haven't had a couple of, like, 20 or 25 page mistakes where I realize this is not working, and I have to backtrack and start over from some point. And that's right there is a key thing, is knowing when you've made a mistake. You know, it's really a gut feeling type thing. You just kind of know it when you know it. And then the second component of that is having the ability to throw out pages. It's hard to do. It took that one I mentioned of 250 pages. That was actually blood work. And I knew in June of the year I was writing that I had a problem, but I did not throw out those pages till August. It took me 3 months of going through the hemming and hawing and the oh, woe is me type thing before I just bit the bullet and threw the pages out and started over.
Mm-hmm. Your beginnings, then, how much do you craft them? Once you have the book is done and you've gone through multiple drafts, do you go back to the beginning and just tweak it until it's just right, or do you feel that it's happened before that point?
No, the beginning, this might be something I've inherited from my editor. I've had the same editor for 10 books, and he probably spends, you know, if I turn in a 500-page manuscript, he probably spends maybe 40 to 50% of his time on the first 100 pages.
Hmm.
just because he thinks those are so important. And, you know, you got to, like, creating an empathic bond between the reader and the protagonist and getting the story moving. There's a lot of stuff that has to be going on in that first 100 pages, which, you know, in a book really comes out to be about 75, a finished book, first 75 pages. His philosophy has always been that those are really key. And so that's transferred to me over years and over books, so that I'm doing that a lot myself. And what I mostly find myself doing is just streamlining those pages, getting the story moving, getting people into the book, getting the reader into the book. And I think that might just be my own writing. Well, I think I had a tendency to put too much into the beginning pages. And this is not what anyone of my readers would now know, because they only see the finished product. But I think what I turn into my editor often is too larded in the beginning. And he's become very skilled at being able to get the story up and moving.
Hmm. What is it weighed down with? Is it weighed down with backstory or just too much detail?
Yeah, I think both. I mean, I think what you want to try doing, or what I try to think in my head, is that I always want a story to be moving forward and backwards at the same time. So that, you know, you're moving forward with this case, this investigation, but you're also moving backward in that you're filling in stuff about your character. And that's where, that filling in is a very much a finessing type thing. And often I lose the finesse and will put in, like, you know, two paragraphs about something in someone's background when it should only be a very brief mention. And I'm a lot better than I am now than I was, you know, seven or eight books ago. And although, like I say, my editor spends a lot of time on these front pages, and I do as well. And you know, I think it's better. I mean, off the top of my head, here's an example. In my second book, on the very, I think it's the very first page, Harry Bosch is looking out. He's at his home. He's on the back balcony, looking across the Cahuenga Pass at a fire, a brush fire burning up the hill. And a fire helicopter's coming in and dropping water. And he has this kind of flash memory of the unsteady helicopter dust off in Vietnam. And it was important to just mention this memory, because it establishes that he was in Vietnam, and establishes that 25 years later, these kind of memories can happen to him. And I think in my original manuscript, I probably wrote three or four sentences about it. And what my editor wanted was just one sentence that just said, you know, the unsteady flight of the fire helicopter reminded him of the dust off in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And not go into the detail of the what the dust off were in Vietnam were like. And it was like a really key, I mean, this is 8 years later, I remember this so well, because it's very important. I mean, that just cutting that down to just this few words really would have triggered something in the reader's mind.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to me giving them so many words that there was no trigger, it was all there.
Sure.
So I think that helped get the reader motivated about Harry Bosch and thinking about him and so forth.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Those three sentences then, did they just go away, or did they go in the back somewhere, or go in the middle somewhere?
In that example, I'm pretty sure they went away. But in other examples, like in one of my books, I think it was the last Coyote, the fourth book, I started with a preface, or a, I don't know what you call it, a prologue or something, but it was Harry Bosch when he was a kid, and it was the last time he had saw his mother before she was murdered. And it was just like, I think, a six-page, in manuscript form, scene where they're having a picnic. And my editor wanted to cut the whole thing because the emotional aspects of that scene were all covered later in the book. That the actual picnic was never mentioned or anything, but what I was saying about the relationship between Bosch and his mother was definitely later in the book. And it wasn't even a fight. I mean, you really got to trust your editor. And so I cut the pages. And I think it was, you know, to this day, I don't regret it. I think it was a really good move because, you know, it got people quicker into the story. They didn't have to slog through a three or four page prologue that took place in 1961. Before they got to what this book is about.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I said, the emotional aspects of that scene were definitely carried into the book later.
Yes. Oh, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Michael Connelly, author of A Darkness More Than Night. Earlier, you said something that I'm dwelling on, and that was that with characters, you create conflict minor to major. And I wonder if we could go back to that, and if you'd say a little more about that, minor to major.
Well, I just think if you agree with the philosophy that character is delineated by conflict and how they overcome conflict, then that's the next part. I mean, if you agree with that or you believe that, then you have to believe in the idea that you want your character to have conflict from minor to major. And so, basically, I just want, we're talking about Harry Bosch, I want him to have conflict on every level of his life. From the minor, he's trying to quit smoking, to the major, he has this homicide he's trying to solve, to the things in the middle, like his own failed romances, and what is it that's flawed in him that he's unable to sustain relationships. The obstacles he has to overcome, obstacles and conflict are the same thing. He has to overcome things within his own department just to solve a murder case. Often the most difficult things he has are the bureaucracy and other obstacles that authorities put in his path. This is all done intentionally with the idea of how he gets around those obstacles is what's going to endear him to readers. It's going to make people think he's a true character or really have this empathic response to him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I'm kind of focused on Angel's Flight because I'm thinking of what you said about writing about something that happened. And when you write about something that happened, like you did in Angel's Flight, how much do you embellish and how much do you hold to the original incident or premise? You know, how much of that remains in the book, that original thing, that original incident?
I don't feel beholden to keeping any of it. I mean, it's really, often with me, it's a touchstone of inspiration. I mean, I had some experiences and views and thoughts about the riots in 1992 that influenced this book, but this book was not set in 92, and the violence that erupts in Angel's Flight, you know, takes place in 1998, so it's more like, you know, it's totally fictional. But a lot of the roots of that violence are the same, and a lot of the way the media dealt with it was exactly the same, all through my personal view. I mean, in Angel's Flight, I really give a difficult time to, or I'm not, I give a very jaundiced view of the television media. And that's just my personal opinion based on what I saw happen in 92. Now, you know, is that true? I don't know. I mean, I think it's true, but that's my own view. I mean, mm-hmm. if you're a television journalist, you might totally disagree with my assessment of what happened in 1992. But I'm working within the framework of fiction, so it allows me that freedom. So I don't even have any second thoughts about that. Two or three of my books have been inspired by real crimes. I think they're all unsolved. One, Concrete Blonde was inspired a little bit by a true crime that was solved, but like the Black Echo, Last Coyote, Trunk Music, these all were, the touchstone of inspiration came from a true murder case that I had knowledge about or that I wrote about as a journalist or something. And I totally fictionalized them and obviously solved them as well. So, you know, you take details and use them as kind of like the skeleton, you know, true details, and that's the skeleton that you add your fiction to.
Mm-hmm. What about titles? Your titles are just resonate. They're just wonderful titles. And how much do you work those? As you read, I heard the title, of course, of the current book in the section that you read, and I'm just curious how you do it with titles.
Well, I mean, it's like I said about names, never lose an opportunity. I mean, if you can have a, what I personally like to find is a title that will have different meanings at different times in a book. And so I do spend a lot of time on it. And sometimes I have a title long before I have a book. I mean, A Darkness More Than Night was a title I came up with. It's taken from it's a churning of words that come from a phrase from Raymond Chandler. And I must have had that in my back pocket for 6 or 7 years and was waiting for the right story that would match to. Angel's Flight was another one. I always wanted to write a book called Angel's Flight because it has at least a couple meanings, and then I came up with the idea of even more metaphoric meanings for it in that book. I mean, I think that, to me, Angel's Flight was my best accomplishment as far as titles go, because I think, and it's like a few years now, it's either 4 or 5 meanings to that in the book. I mean, the Angel's Flight Railroad is 2 train tracks side by side. When one car goes up, one goes down. And in that book, there's a crime, a murder investigation, but at the same time, there's also the disintegration of Bosch's marriage. And so he's like he and his wife are like those cars. One's going up or one's going down. They're passing each other. And that was very significant to me when I was writing that book, that I wanted to keep these 2 tracks and I wanted these cars passing each other in the night kind of aspect to it. And, you know, the City of Angels, Angel's Flight, and, you know, you can go on and on, I think, with meanings to that. So when you can do that, that's great. I mean, I don't do it every time. And I've had titles changed and so forth. And, you know, one book that stands out in my mind as a dismal failure in that regard is The Poet. And it was a book I actually turned in without a title. I could never think of a good title. And even now, I still don't know what I would have called it. All I know is I don't like it. It's called The Poet.
Huh. Did you write as a kid?
Did I write as a kid?
Yeah. Were you going to always be a writer?
I wrote when I was in high school some short stories that were assignments that were like murder mysteries, but it was not at a time where I was even thinking I'd like to be a, you know, a crime novelist. So it's weird. You know, I did not want to become a writer till I was in college.
Interesting. We have another minute left. I always like to ask authors about their agents and any advice regarding agents.
Well, I guess there's a 2 schools. One is like, do you need agents? And one is you don't. I think you definitely do. I mean, and I think if you're a new writer looking for an agent, you should gravitate towards an agent who's representing like-minded writers. In other words, so if you think you're writing like Michael Connelly, for example, then I would send to his agent, as opposed to, you might think, well, he already has Michael Connelly, don't send to him. But the opposite is true, because in my own case, my agent gets requests from time to time about me. Like, is he happy where he's at? Is there any chance he's leaving? I am happy. So my agent could say, no, he's not going anywhere, but guess what? I just landed the next Michael Connelly.
Yes.
So I think it's good to pursue that. So if you were trying to sell a book, I would, you know, try to pull together a list of agents that represent writers that have mined the same vein that you are mining.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for coming on the show and spending all this time talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're sure welcome. And your website address is michaelconnelly.com?
Right.
So that's what it is. Check it out. It's just massive and interesting. And again, thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That was Michael Connelly, author of A Darkness More Than Night. Check out the schedule for this show at writersonwriting.com. And do listen next week when my guest will be Nell Casey, author of Unholy Ghost, Writers on Depression, and Janice Abrams Spring, author of After the Affair. Here's a quote for you by Rita Mae Brown, who said, "Novels, like human beings, usually have their beginnings in the dark." This is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Stay tuned for the Mahalo Lounge with Andy, and thank you as always for listening.